Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 19th of April, 2023, and this is Reconstruction, brought to you by the Construction Index, with me, David Taylor, editor of the magazine, and Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news service.
Morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very excited. It's National Feet Week.
We're still on that, are we? National Feet Week.
And I'm very disappointed that I haven't had a single press release from boot manufacturers to tell me why we should be wearing steel toe cap boots. They've missed a trick there.
Yeah, they definitely have. Well, I'm very glad that I clipped my toenails yesterday. So, you know, I'm obviously entering into the spirit of the foot week.
Our listeners will be delighted to know about that, David.
They will. Anyway, we're not going to talk about feet anymore. There's not much mileage in that. There's a lot of mileage in our first topic. Perfect segue there, Phil.
Yes, very good, David. It's the big story of the week, I think, as far as I'm concerned, is the cancellation of the Smart Motorways programme. The three schemes that are going on at the moment will go ahead. But we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 projects cancelled, which they say comes to more than a billion. And I think it's much more than a billion because just one on its own, the M40, M42 interchange job from Morgan Sindall is supposed to be doing is 300 million. And the M3 job that Balfour Beatty is supposed to be doing is 139 million. So you're going to get up to a billion very, very quickly. So it's masses and masses of civil engineering work that is not now going ahead. Surprisingly, no dent on the share prices of the contractors concerned, as far as I can see.
Oh, that's a good point, yeah.
I suppose it's already priced in because the work had already been paused pending review. And Rishi Sunak had said last summer when he was running to become leader of the Conservative Party and therefore Prime Minister the first time round. He went up against the one he lost to Liz Truss. He said that if he became Prime Minister, he would scrap any more smart motorways. So we knew it was coming, and the announcement finally came over the weekend. It's actually the Prime Minister announced it on Saturday, last Saturday, and then the Transport Secretary, Mark Harper, made a written statement to Parliament confirming what had already been said. And it's interesting and important to note that while a lot of this is all due to the dreadful publicity that smart motorways have had for the people that have been killed, who have been stranded in broken down vehicles with no refuge, no hard shoulder to get to, and there are safety concerns that have been very well aired, it was also specifically mentioned by the Prime Minister that this was due to not just, and I'm going to quote here, the current lack of public confidence felt by drivers and cost pressures.
Yeah.
So there,
which is
there's the nub. It's an easy way to save money without being unpopular. I mean, a lot of people would think you could save a lot more and be a lot more popular if you scrapped HS2. But I think we accept they're scrapping as much as they can, but it's too far gone, the main Old Oak Common to Birmingham bit of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a win-win for Sunak, really, isn't it? Because, as you say, he's making good on a sort of a campaign promise. And we all know, because we've discussed it previously on the podcast, how unpopular smart motorways are with motorists, certainly. And, if you can respond in a listening kind of way to public opinion about something and save money at the same time, well, you know, you're onto a winner, aren't you? It's consistent with the spring budget, which, you know, deferred certain infrastructure projects as well. So, you know, we're cancelling infrastructure jobs all left, right and centre, really.
Interestingly, there's been absolutely no comment from National Highways on this. It still stands, if you go on, it still stands four square behind the whole concept of smart motorways. If you go on their website, they still insist that it's that smart motorways, i.e. motorways without hard shoulders, are much safer than motorways with hard shoulders.
that's a difficult one to...
Well, they use statistics that, you know, show what they want them to show.
Sure.
It'd be nice if someone came out and said, yeah, mea culpa, it was always a bad idea, we should never have done it. But they're not going to say that.
No, of course not, no. I mean, Edmund King, the is he the chief executive of the AA or is he the RAC? I can never remember.
President. He's the AA. Well, it's AA. It's the AA Foundation, which is the sort of research and...
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think he got it in a nutshell. He described it as motorway widening on the cheap. And then he made the remark that at least 40 people have paid the ultimate price. But, you know, we know that there has been some nasty accidents. And another thing, which I think you pointed out in your coverage of this on the website, was that, you know, the smart motorways program had been watered down anyway. Because, of course, turning the hard shoulder into a running lane means that you've got nowhere to hide if you break down. So the idea was that they were going to have regular refuges, sort of like lay-bys, safe places where you could roll to a stop. And they were going to be every sort of 400 or 500 metres,
yes,
something like that.
That was, there was a Mike Penning, who was the Transport Minister at the time when all this went forward. He subsequently gave evidence to the, I think it's the Transport Select Committee in the House of Commons when they were investigating smart motorways. He said, well, it was all based on this original pilot of the M42 that I gave my go-ahead to it. And no one told me that they were going to then not put the refuges in every 400 to 500 metres, but they're going to put them in every 2.5 kilometres instead.
Yeah.
If I'd known that, that's a whole different, you know, kettle of ball games.
Yeah.
So he was basically conned by civil servants, hoodwinked by civil servants. Also, it was promised that hand in hand with the scrapping of hard shoulders would be automatic vehicle detection technology, that as soon as the vehicle stopped, the relevant rescue services authorities would you know, be in like Flynn and come and save you. But none of that stuff went in.
No, exactly. So I think it's going to be a popular move with everybody except maybe the major infrastructure contractors who are hoping to do the work. But I don't think many motorists and members of the general public are going to mourn the disappearance of smart motorways. Do you think they'll ever be revived, the idea, or do you think it's dead in the water now?
I think the variable message boards, the gantries and all of that, we'll see those go in still, I think, because it means the police don't have to sit in the lay-by catching speeding motorists. It's all done automatically, and it makes sure that...
Yeah.
There are a lot of motorists, and I wouldn't for a moment suggest that I'm among them, who hate smart motorways because we can't drive at 90 miles an hour, because they can't drive at 90 miles an hour anymore.
Yeah. Of course, the thing which I think most motorway users really, really hate is the mandatory timed 50-mile-an-hour stretch where they clock you in as you enter the controlled area and clock you out afterwards. And if you complete that route too quickly, you get done. I've been caught once by that, but I always stick to it now because there's no way of getting around it.
Well, we have that a lot on the M20, it seems to me, these days. And the hardest bit is where you got someone in front of you who's going at 50 miles an hour dead, and you're thinking, I know I'm supposed to be only going 50, but I know if I go 53, that's fine. I want to overtake. And so you pull out thinking, I'll just crawl past them and I can go at sort of 52, 53 and I'll be okay. And you can't quite get past them. Then they think, oh, maybe I can get 52. And then you think, oh, damn, I've committed to overtaking this person now. And then you suddenly realise you're doing 57. You think, oh, no, I'm now going to have to do 45 for the next 3 minutes.
Exactly, yeah, to even it all out. There's always somebody, though, in a Range Rover Sport going down there at 70 miles an hour. And I don't know whether they just think that they're immune or they'll just pay the fine.
They're probably the chief constable.
Probably. So yeah, that's the end of smart motorways for the time being, at least.
Well, having said that, there's still 900 million, I think the figure is, going on fixing the stuff that they cheated on in the first place, putting in more frequent refuge bays.
Yeah.
And the automatic vehicle detection technology is going in. I think it's all supposed to go in before the end of this year. Don't know whether it works or not. We'll find out soon enough. There's still a big call for people from the public, or a lot of the public, to put back the hard shoulders that have been removed. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think we're going to.
No, I don't think so. No.
You could do that dead easily. You just put an X in the in the dynamic roads, but just put an X in the lane, the inside lane.
Yeah,
but that's not going to happen.
So that's that.
Yes, and unfortunately, the money is not going to other infrastructure. It's not. I mean, what he could have done is said, we're going to spend this £1 billion on potholes instead, or, you know, give it to local road improvements or bypass programs, but nothing of the sort. It's just going back into Treasury coffers.
Which actually is, as a bit of an aside, you know, people talk about road tax. You know, you tax your vehicle every year, and, well, if you're driving a polluting vehicle, you do anyway. You know, you tax your vehicle every day, and people every year, and everybody says, you know, oh, cyclists don't pay road tax and this, that and the other, not realizing that actually none of the money from vehicle excise duty actually goes into road maintenance or construction. It all goes straight to the Treasury. And so, you know, when people complain about cyclists, for example, acting as if they have the same right to the road as people who pay road tax, well, that's just nonsense.
It's a bit like expecting your beer tax to go to pub upholstery and refurbishment, isn't it? Doesn't happen either.
Are we going to move on to another topic?
Yes. This next story is something that I posted yesterday. It came on the back of the results announcement from Billington, the structural steelwork group, and their results were pretty good. Their profits grew fourfold, 5.8 million profits on turnover up 5% to 87 million. And yeah, all good stuff for Billington, but hidden away, actually not that hidden away, quite prominent in their results statement, was news that they can't get new staff in the UK. And they're doing all the stuff that they should be doing in terms of partnering with local colleges and universities, attending careers days, hosting school visits, doing this all training and this, that and the other. They've got a partnership with a specialist welding training organisation. And this is, as I see it, you know, if we take at face value everything they say, no fault of their own. Young people in Britain don't want to be welders, don't want to work in construction, don't want to work for a steelwork fabricator. And therefore, 80%, broadly speaking, of the people they had recruited last year were from overseas. Now, that 80% is a bit of a... The actual numbers is that last year, in 2022, their staff numbers increased from 383 to 415, which is a net addition of 32, but obviously people come and go. But what we do know is 26 members were recruited from overseas. Now, that could have been that all 26 only stayed a week. But I'm assuming that the 26 stayed and they're still there. So on that basis, a net addition of 32, of which 26 were recruited from overseas because they couldn't find anyone in the UK. And
incredible.
I suspect that, you know, Billington are by no means unusual, abnormal in this. I suspect it's happening across maybe manufacturing as well as construction industry, industry where hard labour is involved. You know, young people want cushy jobs. You know, I'd say they don't want to get their hands dirty, they don't want to weld, and they simply can't get the people. And it is. I mean, I noticed one person sort of reposting on this on social media, sort of did a hashtag Brexit. Well, clearly Brexit's got nothing to do with this. Billington aren't saying we want foreign, you know, we want Eastern Europeans, but we can't get them anymore. It's getting overseas people. There doesn't seem to be a problem with getting people from overseas. This is just a problem of, as I see it, of the the youth of today.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, steel fabrication, I suppose, is the sort of the ultimate metal bashing industry, which is not glamorous, and it seems maybe a little old-fashioned and, you know, something out of the 19th century rather than a... I mean, people, young kids now, they just want to be TikTokers and Instagram influencers, don't they? Presumably that's how they see their career panning out.
Whatties and whatters.
You can earn much better work, much better money making TikTok videos and doing stuff like that rather than...
I'm sorry, I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, I see. You're winding me up, Phil. You're winding me up. I know. I bet you've got a channel as well. But you can see why maybe it's not as glamorous and not as attractive as maybe some of the job opportunities out there. But, I mean, it's a proper job and a skilled job. And, you know, not everybody can be a media personality. It's astonishing. And I'd love to know where from overseas Billington is getting these skills. I'm assuming, as you hinted just now, it probably is from Eastern Europe, certainly from Europe. Don't know where else they'd be coming from, probably not Sub-Saharan Africa or South America or anywhere like that. There are people out there, though, who actually want jobs. And, you know, as you said, Billington is a successful company. It's a well-known player in its field. It's highly respected. And some of the jobs it works on are very, very interesting. I mean, I'd say that career opportunities with a firm like Billington are pretty good. And it's a sort of perpetual puzzlement to me that the companies like that struggle to attract school leavers and people from university. I mean, it works with Sheffield University's, I can't remember which department, engineering department. Sheffield, I mean, there must be some Sheffield engineering undergraduates who would love a job at Billington, surely. You know, why aren't they working there?
Because they're getting jobs at Google and Facebook instead or whatever.
But yeah, maybe.
We talked I think it was last month, about how, in the context of the budget, how the construction industry organisations, trade associations and so on, have been lobbying for a relaxation of immigration controls on key skills in the construction industry, for the construction industry. Yeah. And they, you know, won that battle, and a lot of the construction trades are being added to the points based system for immigration, and I think we said at the time, certainly it's something I feel, is that it sounds like a pity that the construction industry is lobbying government for relaxed immigration instead of training up and recruiting and inspiring young British people. Now, clearly, as Billington shows, that's an unfair comment from me, because companies like Billington are doing their damnedest to try and get young British people. But British people just don't want to know, it seems.
It's not something which is unique to the UK, actually. I'm just thinking aloud here, because I've run a couple of stories recently on the international page of the website about the Association of General Contractors of America. Can't quite remember what the trade association is, but basically it's an the organization that represents American contractors. That's called on the government, the American government, to relax immigration regulations because it can't get the skills from within the United States, which seems even worse than, I mean, they've got a lot more people there.
Yes, we mentioned that before as well. They want to tear down the wall.
That's right, yeah.
So they get more people in to build walls.
So, you know, it's... Why is it? Maybe it's because people in developed countries like the UK and the United States mollycoddled, and they expect to get more money for less work, or more money for more agreeable work. I don't know. Maybe they're just shy of doing a proper day's work. I don't know.
To be fair, though, David, I think I'd rather sit here nattering to you on Zoom than be in a workshop welding things and fabricating things and getting my hands dirty.
I'm not sure I agree with you there, because as I think I've mentioned previously on this podcast, one of my...
You're a bit of a whiz at metalwork, aren't you?
Well, one of my A-levels was craftwork metal, it was called, and it was basically lathe work, milling, turning, bit of foundry work and some forge work, and I was encouraged to do that by my dad, who was a mechanical engineer, aeronautical engineer, actually, but he had a home workshop, which I inherited when he died, And I've got a screw cutting lathe out in my shed, which still isn't connected to the electricity. And one of my projects this spring is that I'm going to get that sorted out so my workshop is up and running. So I'd actually quite like to do a job like that. Maybe not for a living, but certainly as a hobby, I'd be more than happy to do that. But anyway, I'm sure I'm not typical in that respect. I think you're probably right that nattering away to your colleagues over Zoom is certainly an easier way of earning a living than being a steelwork fabricator out on site.
You say you're not typical. I think you absolutely are typical. You've got the skills, you've got the tools, you've got the knowledge, and still you'd rather sit at a desk tapping away at a keyboard.
Yeah, mea culpa. Yeah, so I think it's a crying shame that Billington can't attract more young people into the industry from the UK. But there are young people in the industry. And maybe I think another story which you ran very recently, and in fact you've written about it at length in the latest issue of the magazine, which will be out in a couple of weeks' time, is a contractor up in the north of England, which has set up something which it calls a shadow board, which is a concept I wasn't familiar with. And it's, why don't you explain what a shadow board is, Phil? You've written about this extensively, so take it away.
Yes, well, I had a good chat with Lee Powell, the newish chief executive of GMI, whose initiative this is. A shadow board, he encountered it listening to a business podcast, he told me, and they were talking about them. And they're not a brand new thing, but they seem new to construction. I mean, for example, Gucci has had one since 2015. What the concept is, a shadow board, is you get a group of young people within the organisation, a panel, who act as a shadow to the main executive board. And I think we're generally not talking about the sort of a PLC type board with non-executive directors. And we're talking about executive boards, management boards, the board that is involved in the day-to-day running of the business. And you have a group of young people who sit in on some or all of those meetings and contribute and shadow them. And it works two ways. On the one hand, the young people who are identified as potential future leaders of the company develop their understanding of how the business runs or how a business runs and get insight into what's going on, and it prepares them for leadership roles in the future. And conversely, at its best, it injects a bit of new thinking into the board itself, which, as Lee Powell said to me, there is a risk that you know, particularly in the construction industry, boards can be, you know, male, pale and stale. He didn't use that, but he did say they had a certain stereotypical demographic, and they can be something of an echo chamber. And to get a millennial perspective, and if these young people are given the confidence to risk saying something out of turn, or that they might think, oh, I shouldn't say that, that might sound stupid. If they've got the confidence to actually speak, and given the confidence to speak, there might be some, pearls of wisdom or new insights. Yeah. And interestingly, another organization that's had success with shadow boards is Accor Hotels, which, when the rise of Airbnb came along, the typical middle-aged directors of Accor Hotels, the manager thought, what do we do about this? How do we address this? And they turned to their 20-somethings, their millennials, to form a strategy for competing with Airbnb. And I thought, that's quite interesting, because you turn to the people who are using Airbnb, early adopters of these sort of technologies or services, and you get them involved in the business.
Yeah. Well, I think you must have been reading the same article in the Harvard Business Review as I've been reading, because I recognise both of those examples. But the one which really caught my attention was Stora Enso, the Finnish paper and packaging company. I get press releases from them occasionally, and never use them. They're never relevant. But this is interesting that they got a shadow board, and what they did was, well, I'll read it, actually. They appointed this shadow board to revise how the executive committee assigned work. And until this shift, work was assigned to groups that the executives considered experts and therefore best suited to the assignment. The shadow board convinced them to assign certain tasks to non-experts, arguing with that an unbiased view would increase the chance of breakthroughs. One project aimed at reducing supply chain lead time had stumped a supposedly expert team. The new team came up with a workable plan within 6 months. No team members came from the business units in question, nor had they any prior supply chain experience. And I think that is obviously a success for a shadow board. If you can really bring fresh thinking to a problem like that and solve it, at a stroke, then there's clearly something going on here that is worth exploring. I mean, I think shadow boards, we should point out, the shadow boards aren't like a permanent appointment. You're a member of the shadow board and you're not going to be a member of the shadow board for life. I think that GMI,
it's a year.
They're appointed for a year, aren't they?
They give him a year's term, and he's given and there's four of these 20-somethings, and they're from different disciplines. There's a design manager, a quantity surveyor, and two site managers from the four different regional offices that GMI has. And next year, the idea is that they'll pick four more people.
Yeah.
And GMI is growing at such a rate, fourfold turnover growth last year, threefold turnover growth, 400% growth last year, at such a rate that it's not going to run short of new talented young people to be on the shadow.
No.
But the first year task, they've been given a specific task to give it focus. They're not just sort of sitting in meetings, drinking tea and chipping in or not chipping in. They've got a specific job is to cut £1 million from operating costs by end of September, which is the end of the financial year, I think. What would be really interesting is what the actual results are that come out of it.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's clearly an idea that works or has worked for some people, Store and So. And as you said, Gucci and, this Accor Hotels, it's not specific to any particular sector. It could work for any company, I should think. And I can certainly see that in construction, which of course is always frequently accused of being stuck in the mud and being old-fashioned and unoriginal in its approach, then something like a shadow board could really make a difference, I think, to many, many contractors.
It's interesting that what Lee Powell told me is that when he was listening to this podcast about shadow boards, thinking, that's a good idea, it took him back to his own days as a sponsored student, as a trainee quantity surveyor with Tarmac, as it then was in the pre-Korean days. And he was saying that they didn't have shadow boards exactly, but they were definitely made to feel, the culture of the organisation, he was definitely made to feel that he wasn't just some junior dog's body. Actually, there was a degree of empowerment and his voice was valued and heard. And having become chief executive of GMI, I was looking for ways of maintaining the culture of the organization as the company grew as a smaller sub 100 million turnover. It's one thing to make all staff feel like they have a role and a voice and are heard, but as the company grew, how you can maintain that. And he thought shadow board would be his way of generating or maintaining the culture of cohesiveness within the organisation.
Yeah, I think that is obviously a problem with a growing company, that you do lose sight of what's happening on the ground, as it were, as you get bigger, especially if as a chief executive officer or somebody high up in the organisation, you're focused on the future and future growth. It's probably quite easy to forget what's going on behind you, and the people you're employing will feel a little bit out in the cold, maybe. So, and with a small company, of course, everybody's part of the team and everybody knows each other's names, and you feel like you're part of a group effort to do something. But big organisations can be very faceless and unwelcoming. So I suppose that this is perhaps one way in which you can continue to engage people, if you like, at the beginning of their careers. Yes, in fact, there was a similar sort of idea that we actually discussed. We had somebody on the podcast, didn't we, over a year ago now.
You're thinking of Ayu Agambambi of Balfour Beatty.
That's right, yes, who was reverse mentoring the chief executive, no less.
Yes.
And that's, of course, a different thing. That's not a shadow. That's not shadowing. That's reverse mentoring. He was using her as a sounding board, if you like, wasn't he, too?
But it's another way of getting millennial or younger person input or perspective into, potentially cynical. Sorry, Lee, I'm sure you're not, but you know what I mean. potentially long in the tooth leadership. Also making future leaders or potential future leaders feel valued, and it just all goes to the whole, we talked about recruitment with Billington. This is about retention. It's not enough just to get people in. You have to keep people in, and these sort of initiatives are a great way of, demonstrating, not just telling, but demonstrating to your young employees that they have a very important role within the organization.
Yes, I think it has another function as well, which probably isn't as quite as important, but it sort of breaks down this sort of perceived barrier between the people at the bottom of the pyramid, if you like, and those at the top. I mean, if Leo Quinn, for example, sort of pitched up unannounced on a Balfour Beatty site or in one of their regional offices, I bet people would be, oh, look, Leo Quinn's in. Oh, and they'd stand up when he came into the room or, whatever it is. I've been in situations like that. Earlier on in my career, I worked for GEC Avionics for a year, which was bloody awful. BAE Systems, as it is now. And I can remember the managing director of the company coming into our office once, and everything went silent. Everybody was heads down at their desk, didn't want to be picked on, if you like, because he was the big man and he was important and all the rest of it. And I think if you sort of dispel or dilute that mystique, and you can speak to them as an equal, obviously you don't want to get disrespectful or anything like that. You've got to respect the person's seniority, but if they show an interest in you and you can talk to them as, on equal terms, then that is good for morale, I think.
I've worked in organisations where having anyone from the executive management come around the office was rather like having Princess Anne visit your school. It really was sort of, brush your hair, stand up straight, do your top button, and
absolutely
coming in. Yeah. And you don't want that. You need to be able to have that good communication. And while you're talking, I was looking up when it was that we had Ayo Agunbanbi on our podcast, and it was our 6th of October 2021, episode 83, if people want to go back and listen to that discussion about reverse mentoring.
Yeah, that was an interesting one. So, there's quite a lot going on out there, really.
What's our next topic, David?
Oh, we're going to talk about carbon, aren't we? Or in the broadest possible terms, we're going to talk about there was something about heat pumps recently. You again, one of your stories, I think, online.
This is simply a press release that the Boilermakers put out. The Energy and Utilities Alliance chief executive Mike Foster, he gives good quotes, basically, and he's the leading, or appears to be the leading spokesperson agitator against the I'm sure it's not against heat pumps, but he's against the potentially ill thought out.
You're trying to be diplomatic, Phil. He's basically pro boiler, isn't he?
It's pro boiler, that's his job. But there does seem to, what I'd sympathize with him is there does seem to be this, and it's a bit like, we've talked about HVO as being this sort of drift towards HVO and this drift towards battery powered plant, where in fact hydrogen may be better. And there seems to be this drift towards, and from a government perspective at least, heat pumps, where, in his view, it's ill thought out, and they're not necessarily the best thing. They're expensive, they're not appropriate for everywhere. And he doesn't say so, but I suspect he's more a fan of putting hydrogen in the pipes and to power existing boilers that many of us have got at the moment. Yeah. So Mike Foster was commenting on the fact that the £150 million budget that the government had set aside to subsidise the installation of 30,000 heat pumps in England and Wales last year was not terribly well taken up. Fewer than 10,000 households took advantage of their £5,000 subsidy voucher, which means that £90 million unspent, gone back to the Treasury. And as he says, it takes a certain type of genius to fail to give away £150 million of taxpayers' money. and this wretched scheme looks like it's done just that. And this all goes back to the Green Deal and all these other government schemes to try and give Johnny homeowner and Jenny homeowner financial incentives to decarbonize their properties or to improve their insulation, etc. And none of them work, or none of them have worked so far.
No, exactly. And the government is has been quite keen to promote the idea of heat pumps. I mean, they have been sort of mooted as the future of domestic heating and hot water, and clearly that's taking the argument isn't actually getting through. One of the things which we actually had an email from somebody, a PR person, representing an organisation called Mixergy, which is a terrible word, but one of these companies which has been spun out of a university. In this case, it's the University of Oxford.
Hang on, is it a university in Oxford? How long's that been there?
Oh, it's been around for, I think not very long, less than 1,000 years.
How do you know if someone's been to Oxford?
I don't, if you wait long enough, they'll tell you.
You don't have to wait any time at all.
Anyway, so it's how these things work. Trying to translate research into commerce. Anyway, this organisation, Mixergy, you sent me this email and said, let's talk about that if you understand it. And I have to confess right away that I'm not sure I really do understand it, because this is, I think, the key part of this awful name, Mixergy, is in the mix, because it's a device which is a combination of a hot water tank, basically, and a heat pump. Let me see if I can find the relevant part of the message. It says that homeowners and housing associations have the option of an integrated heat pump and hot water cylinder that fits in with modern life. This is a clever bit. It's quick to heat water, built to be installed or retrofitted easily, and it's smart too. Learning to adapt to how and when a household typically wants hot water. So here you are, you've got a problem. You've probably got one, Phil, stuck in a corner of your utility room. It's a hot water cylinder, and your boiler heats up the water and your cylinder stores it. Well, the bit I don't understand is, well, there's quite a lot about it I don't understand, but it's got this heat pump inside it, but it isn't completely autonomous. It needs a heat source, and that can be another heat pump or a solar panel, or it can be a fossil fuel boiler, a traditional boiler. And I don't know what the integral heat pump actually does in that respect, because if you've already got a source of heat, maybe it's like a preamp and a power amp in the old-fashioned hi-fi setup, that your integrated heat pump actually boosts the energy coming from your primary heat source, I'm guessing now. But anyway, so this thing, it stores the hot water and it keeps it hot and it heats it from the top, so it's more efficient. I don't understand that. But it learns how the user requires the delivery of their hot water. So it's obviously got some sort of machine learning built into it, so that it will know, they're going to turn the shower on in a minute, so I better make sure that they've got enough hot water. And it'll respond, or it'll anticipate demand. And if that's true, then it is clever. Cleverer than you or I, Phil, because I don't understand it.
Does it tell you when you need a shower?
No, I think that your life partner will tell you that. It just knows when you
need
a shower. Yeah, exactly. It's got a website, mixergy.co.uk. And so if you're interested, you can go and visit that and find out more about it. I've had a look, but I've still got some questions which haven't been answered. Not that I've asked them. I haven't asked them any questions, but it raised questions. And I think it's an interesting idea. Of course, the Internet of Things and machine learning and smart devices and all the rest of it are what we've come to expect now from developments in all walks of life, not just construction. In fact, mainly not construction. But having a boiler and a hot water cylinder that will know when you need hot water is definitely a step forward in my book.
You say that, I'm getting increasingly scared of technology. The stuff I've been reading about AI and ChatGPT.
Oh, yes.
Well, I've got to be honest, I'm not sure ChatGPT is all it's cracked up to be. I asked for the an explanation of the first of all, I was asked for the I said soccer, so in case it was American and didn't understand what I was talking about, offside rule. Fine with that. So I said, okay, try the field hockey offside rule. And it first came out with something gibberish. And so I said, no, try again. And then it came out with the offside rule as it was about 30 years ago. And it took three goes to get anywhere close to what the field hockey offside rule is. So not all that. And then there was that story about an Australian, was he a banker? Is a banker turned politician or something? And he had blown the whistle on some big financial corruption scandal.
That's right. Yeah.
And according to ChatGPT, he was actually the crook who had perpetrated the scandal. And so he's saying, well, yes. this is slandering if it was spoken, libeled if it was written down.
But yeah, but who do you sue?
This is defaming me. Well, no, ChatGPT has an owner. I don't know who it is, but he's claiming money off them. And if...
Oh, really? Apparently, I read that story as well, and it, not only did it point the finger at him as the perpetrator of this fraud, it actually completely fabricated a newspaper article to cite that accusation. It was a completely fictional newspaper article. I didn't write the article. The article didn't exist. It put it in a footnote. But... it'd be great if I could get ChatGPT to write the magazine for me. That would give me far more time to spend in my workshop. But my son, who is currently living in London and working in a job that doesn't satisfy him, is very busily job hunting at the moment. And he's applied for numerous jobs.
Billington?
No, Billington. Yeah, maybe you ought to join them. But he's been very assiduous at applying for jobs and hasn't really had any luck. And then he phoned me up the other day and said, Dad, can I read out this this covering letter I'm sending off for this job application? And he read it out to me and I said, yeah, that's great. You've pressed all the right buttons. And he said, yeah, that ChatGPT wrote that for me. So he sent it off and he got an interview. It was the first interview. I don't know how many jobs he's applied for so far this year. This is the first one that the next day they got in touch with him. He didn't get the job, unfortunately, but he got the interview.
He did the interview himself rather than get ChatGPT to do it.
Yeah, exactly. That's probably true. So I was deeply impressed by that. So maybe the next issue of the magazine will be written by an AI and not by me.
It's not just the ChatGPT thing. There've been the story that AI. There's a German photographer anyway, who won this big international photography competition and then said, yeah, here's your prize back. I didn't really take a photo. I did that by AI. So he wasn't cheating. He was just testing the system and fessed up as soon as he won.
Yeah.
And then there's something about someone's formed an AI version of Oasis because they're fed up waiting for them to reform. And there's, you know, various people are doing AI versions of, I don't know, whether it's Taylor Swift or Bob Dylan or whoever you care to think of. You can just simply recreate.
And Spotify had to delete them. Yeah,
it's strange world.
Yeah, a bit scary. It is a bit scary, but we're real human beings. Well, I haven't seen you in the flesh for a long time, Phil. So I'm assuming you're not a chatbot.
Certainly pre-COVID.
Yeah, indeed. So AI is good, but it's a bit scary. I think that's our conclusion.
Right. Well, let's wrap it up there before ChatGPT takes our jobs away.
Yeah. Absolutely.
One thing I must tell you, listeners, is that I forgot to use the best line that I had stored for today's episode, which our producer Tom, who is a 20-something and more in the shade of the GMI shadow board than the board, which is more David and I's age group, he's saying, what are we going to talk about today then, David and Phil? And I said, well, we're going to talk about this shadow board that GMI has set up. And he said, what's that all about? And I explained it. And he said, oh, you mean like S Club Juniors?
Of course, it was lost on me. I didn't know what he was talking about.
David had no idea. At least I didn't know what he was talking about.
You're down with the kids, Phil.
If anyone from GMI is listening, I suspect that the shadow board are now going to be called S Club Juniors from here on in. And you've got Tom, producer Tom, to thank for that. But no, for another episode, David, are we done? Do we have anything else to talk about?
Yeah, I think that's it. I think, yeah, before we get Tom into trouble.
Good stuff. And blimey, we'll be back in May, people, 2 weeks' time.
Yes, Indeed.
So we'll see you then. So thank you once again very much indeed for listening. So that's from David and I. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.